Hi, this is Doug Wells, host of The Bottom Line. As you know, this show focuses on the entrepreneurial journey, the human stories behind building and running a successful company. Something you might not realize is that this show itself is an entrepreneurial venture. Very meta, I know. We launched this show over 2 years ago because there are so many important stories out there that need to be told. I'm talking about stories of regular people building new technologies or companies to solve problems and meet a market demand. Stories are powerful. They teach us new skills, help us pass on lessons learned by others, and they can pave a way for new ideas and innovation. There is indeed a thriving entrepreneurial ecosystem here in Utah, a network of symbolic, creative people all working hard to build a better future. Please consider contributing to this effort. Help us continue to tell these important stories. KCPW is the public radio station that makes this program possible. It's a small station with a small staff, but a big heart. They are innovators, and they're excited about moving things forward. Please go to kcpw.org and make a financial contribution. Thank you, and thanks for listening. This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Jeremy Andrus, CEO of Traeger Pellet Grills. Most of us have grills in our backyards, primarily fueled by charcoal, propane, or maybe even natural gas. The barbecue purists in the audience are chuckling at our simplistic grilling devices. They know that smoking meat brings out the best flavor. However, it's also a lot of work. In 1986, Joe Traeger combined the ideas of traditional wood-smoking barbecues with the convenience of pellet wood systems that already fueled some fireplaces and ovens. If it worked there, why wouldn't it work for barbecue grills? He was right, and the U.S. Patent Office granted him a patent. For nearly 20 years, the Traeger family had exclusive rights to make and sell wood pellet barbecue grills. Life was good. And it stayed good until the patent expired almost 20 years later. In 2006, the Traeger family sold their business to a private equity group known as the Bearish Fund. In 2013, another private equity group, Trilantic, invested in the company. Shortly after that investment, Jeremy Andrus was recruited to be Traeger's CEO. Previously, Jeremy had been CEO of Skullcandy, where he helped take the company from a tiny team with big dreams to a major player in the music business, complete with endorsements from top-ranked celebrities. Over the course of a few years, Jeremy and Skullcandy co-founder Rick Alden took the company from about $1 million in sales to over $300 million a year in sales, and eventually they took the company public. Join me this morning to hear about Jeremy's entrepreneurial journey, and in the process, maybe even get inspired to upgrade that traditional barbecue grill in your backyard. Jeremy Andrus, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
I'm happy to be here.
So tell us about the barbecue grill business. Is it a pretty big business?
You know, it actually is a very big business, and it's a fairly mature industry, which is why when I first took a look at it, I said, I don't know if this industry is for me, but we found a gem in this industry, which is Traeger, that I think is super interesting.
And what makes it a gem?
Traeger is a gem because it is the best consumer product that no one's ever heard of. It's been around for 30 years. And, you know, what really surprised me when I found it with Trilantic was that there was a level of customer passion that I have never seen in any brand before. They just, if they owned a Traeger, they loved it. But it really hadn't made it outside of the Pacific Northwest.
So you said something just then. You said when you found it with Trilantic. So were you doing a search to buy an operating company like Traeger?
I was. I was an entrepreneur in residence with a fund back in Boston called Solomir Capital. And my intent in partnering with these guys was not to be a deal guy, but it was to have a captive check that I go out and buy a business. And so as I was in that search fund, a group, Trilantic Capital Partners, who I'd known for years, they'd looked at Skullcandy back in the day. They called me and said, hey, we found something interesting. Do you want to talk about it?
So you just used another term, search fund, which is a very specific term in this kind of industry. I don't know if you're using it generally or, you know, at Harvard, they probably talked about the search fund model. Were you doing kind of a traditional search? We've had local searchers here, like Diamond Rentals mm-hmm. was bought through a search fund. And we have another gentleman whose name's escaping me right now. Were you doing a traditional search fund or borrowing just elements from that?
You know what? It was not a formalized search fund. I effectively called some guys that I'd known back in the day who ran Solimere. And I said, I'm going to go buy a business. Do you want to co-invest with me? Do you want to help write a check? And so I left Skullcandy to do that. And the only formality behind it was that I had a captive capital partner joining me.
So another thing of a traditional search fund is they're also paying your salary, a meager salary,
yep.
usually during that period of time. Was that your model? Or did you say, you know what, I had this big success at Skullcandy. I don't need to worry about that aspect of it.
It was the latter. I was at a point where I didn't need a salary. And candidly, I also didn't want to be I wanted the flexibility to look at anything that I wanted to look at a pace that I wanted to look at it for. So I'd spent 8 years at Skullcandy, which was just – it was rapid, just rapid-fire pace. I moved into my parents' basement. I later got married, had a bunch of kids, and I said, I'm going to work at my pace. And so – I actually said, I don't want a salary. I want to feel committed to myself and finding the right deal as opposed to feeling a need to work a 5 or 6 day week.
So lining up that funding check has its pros and cons.
Yeah.
The pro is you know the money's there.
Yep.
Historically, if it's a good deal, if it's an interesting company, the money's always there. It's finding the good deals at the right terms that's hard.
Absolutely.
So knowing that the money's there to back you is a big advantage. It also comes with some disadvantages too. How did you weigh that? You know, the commitment to give Trilantic the first look. Maybe somebody else would give you as the finder a better deal than Trilantic. How did you weigh the pros and cons of that?
Well, so interesting that's why I chose a flexible. My partnership was with Solimere Capital, and what I wanted was to be credible. When I spoke to a buyer, I wanted them to know that I had capital behind me so that I can move quickly in a competitive process. But ultimately, I didn't find the deal. Trilantic found the deal, and they brought it to me. And so I had created the flexibility with Solimere such that if they didn't find the deal or I didn't bring the deal or I didn't find it myself, I could go anywhere. And so love the Solimere guys, would love to have done a deal with them. But the guys I knew at Trilantic found the business.
And the guy with the deal gets oftentimes has the power in that.
100%. So. Look, the scarcity is deal and management, not money these days.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're going to talk more about your personal journey later, but bringing up the process of how you found Traeger is we're talking about it now, so I just want to go with that. Your comment that you wanted to have credibility with sellers. You know, it's interesting. I did a search fund when I got out of Stanford, actually. And it was, to me, it was the way to leverage the biggest bang for the experience that I just had. You know, common sense told me I needed to go out and work for 6 years. I needed to take that job with McKinsey right. and then maybe move on to Goldman Sachs. And then, quote unquote, I'd be ready.
Yep.
And it's amazing how we never feel ready. I mean, here... Your journey at Skullcandy was a wild success.
Yep.
I mean, what you guys did was so hard. The world did not need better earbuds when
That's
you
so
launched
true.
Skullcandy. What you created was an incredible brand.
Yep.
And it's so very hard to do that. And even with that experience, when you left Skullcandy, you wanted the credibility that came with an outside private equity group like
right.
Solimere Group. Looking back at that now, what advice would you give that launching CEO from Skullcandy? Did you need that partnership?
Well, so I want to step back first to something you said, which is my career was very strategic for a long period of time. I was a consultant. I was an investment banker. And my career didn't actually get good until I quit my job and I joined the founder of Skullcandy. And so I do think there's this element of willingness to step out on a limb and do something, which is hard for people to do, even people who are inherently entrepreneurial. And so when I left Skull Candy to do this, I knew that I had a story to tell as an operator. Having a partnership only had upside. It didn't have downside to me. There was no economic arrangement, but there was someone who was willing to move quickly in a process. And sometimes it's a little bit, you know, when you have a seller in a competitive process, the ability to say, I'm not just an operator, but I've got a capital check. I've got a capital partner. It felt like the right way to approach it.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Jeremy Andrus. He's currently the CEO of Traeger Pellet Grills and was past CEO of Skull Candy. You talked about a more traditional career, the McKinsey Consulting, the Monitor Group. You know, interestingly, when you have those great experiences, kind of the experience that all of your graduating classmates, you guys were competing for those cherry positions. You're obviously very smart, you're hardworking, and you were able to land those positions. It raises the stakes, though, and it makes it even harder to go out and do something entrepreneurial.
It certainly does. And I see this all the time. People ask me, what is the right time to be an entrepreneur? And part of it's when you have the right concept or the right business. The other is when you're actually willing to take the risk. And what I see is that the longer someone has stayed in consulting or banking or private equity or whatever the career path is, the more your lifestyle has grown, your family has grown, your need for some working capital, some income has grown. And I had the luxury of being a single guy and quitting my job in San Francisco and moving into my parents' basement in Park City. And so for me, the willingness to take the risk early meant everything.
So let's talk about risk, because I think that's really important for entrepreneurs. In hindsight, now you had a big success, but in hindsight, and not everybody does, most don't. In hindsight, what is the risk of entrepreneurship?
So I have a greater appreciation looking back, if I were to be honest. When I joined Skull Candy, my gut said it was a great opportunity. I believed we could build a brand, and it evolved a lot over time. But when I got to the end of it, I looked back and I said, I can't believe that with $800,000 of equity, we built a brand that took market share from Sony and from Bose and Philips and Panasonic. And so this concept around risk is that, you know, the reality is that most people work hard. Most people are smart who are entrepreneurs. Most people have access to some capital. And most of those early stage ventures don't succeed. And so I have an appreciation for that risk. And fortunately, I guess ignorance is bliss. I made it through it. And we all worked hard, but there was a lot of luck to that process. And so I think being really smart about where do you optimize risk versus return? And that may not necessarily be day one of a startup.
And that's a really good point, because of just how improbable success is, how difficult the journey is. You know, when people ask me the risk of entrepreneurship, to me the bigger risk, now I'm 52, right? I've gone through many of the chapters of my professional career. You know, my wife and I are starting to think about what does retirement look like. The biggest risk of entrepreneurship for me would have been not doing it. Mm. Because now it's kind of too late. And you go from being too young and inexperienced to being too old and too late very, very quickly. Yeah. The biggest risk of entrepreneurship is not doing it, but choosing wisely is important.
Yes.
You mentioned that in your gut, it felt right, Skull Candy. When you talked to this with your wife, it sounds like you were married at the time. When you talked about the Skull Candy opportunity with your wife, when you talked about it with your Harvard classmates, what were they telling you?
Well. So interestingly, my Harvard classmates, they gave me a lot of crap for joining this little skate snow-inspired brand, because they're all bankers.
It was, quote-unquote, beneath you.
Oh, absolutely. They were bankers. They were private equity guys. And we get together and we golf once a year. And I remember in 2007 being in Phoenix with these guys. And they're sort of snickering around the table, hey, how's that little skate brand doing? And I will tell you that in 2009, there was a different conversation going on, because Skull Candy was growing like crazy through a recession. And these guys were out of work. They were underworked in banking. Their funds weren't doing well. And, you know, I got to tell you, I thought a lot about the risk. I'm not sure that I totally understood it, but my life is so different because I was an entrepreneur. I mean, it is the best thing that happened to me, not just from a financial perspective, but just a sheer enjoyment of building and of careers that, you know, was there a chance that I would have missed out on that? Absolutely. I mean, a lot had to happen right, not just for Skull Candy to succeed, but that moment in time where I said, I'm just totally bored in my job right now.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I'd add, we're fortunate, Ross and I, Ross Chambliss, the producer of the show, we get to talk to a lot of entrepreneurs. Most are later stage entrepreneurs like yourself. Occasionally we have early entrepreneurs come in, and there's something about your outlook on life, there's something about your self-confidence that comes from taking something from a dream to a reality. Now, for the younger entrepreneurs, there's still a big journey in front of them. It's unknown whether or not it's going to end in financial success for them, but just watching them go from somebody that maybe is uncertain, maybe thinking they don't have all the experience they need, maybe they think they're too young, and then to make some impossible things happen, there's something very powerful in your life that happens when you do that.
It's awesome. And I got to tell you, it's interesting because I look back, as long as I can remember, I had a lot of self-confidence. But I remember a lot of days at Skull Candy asking myself, okay, we got a mountain to run up, and I don't know exactly what tomorrow looks like, but I think we're going to figure it out. And there's this sort of, there's this confidence mixed with uncertainty that is really powerful, that gives an entrepreneur a ton of energy. And it was interesting because I got to the end of Skull Candy and I said, whoa, I did it once. Can I do it a second time? And now that I'm having such an awesome experience the second time with Traeger, I've got this mindset, which is, I think I can do this over and over. And I wouldn't say my level of confidence has changed in me, but my sense for the patterns that you see in building a business is just much sharper than it was.
Well, let's take a short break and then let's talk some more about that. So before break, we were talking about doing it the second time and starting to recognize some patterns of what it takes to succeed as a CEO. What are some of those patterns? What are some things that you view as critical to being a successful CEO now, having done it for the second time?
You know, I think it starts with this concept of working really hard doesn't necessarily mean you're making progress. As I look back and I thought about the lessons I had learned, there were times at Skull Candy where I think we mistook action for progress. And so as I had this opportunity to think back around what I knew we did well and what I could have done better, I really focused the second time on sort of filling in the gaps where I thought we could do better. First and foremost is team. There is an art to building team which really directs the course of the success of a business. And as you learn to not only put the right pieces together, but to recognize winning qualities in people, it's ultimately how you win. You start with a great concept, but you don't end with a great concept. You end with a great team. And that's how you finish, and that's how you win.
You always recruit a great team, or do you have to make the team great?
So I am a big believer that a CEO focuses on, from a team perspective, he filters for quality people and the right cultural values. And so can you make people great? But I think that's a hard way to win. There's no question you provide motivation and encouragement and vision and energy, but when you start with great people who view the world in a similar way from a vision and a disruption perspective, it's a lot better way to win. Start with the talent.
Let me tell you why I asked that. You know, we're talking about investment banking and management consulting. The best and the brightest are going after those positions right out of college. It's one thing to manage a team of folks like that, and there's a lot of issues, right? You got these superstars, and The biggest issue is, how do you get them to play nicely in a sandbox together and work for the company for the benefit of the client as opposed to the benefit of the individual? When you're working in the basement of your mother's house, you and a couple other people wondering how you're going to make payroll next week, the type of person that you can attract is different. And how do you set up the system so that the guy that's not the rock star graduating from the University of Utah or an elite school, how do you make it so that somebody that's more normal, more average, like all of us, how do you help them succeed and do great things?
You know, I think there's no question that, you know, guys going into banking and consulting are high horsepower intellectually. And the team that I built at Skullcandy and the team that I've built at Traeger, there are some elements of that. But that's not most of the team. Most of the team I would describe as slightly more blue-collar, state school educated, down and dirty. They're grinders. They believe in a vision, and they're part of a team. Actually, I look at the consultants and bankers, and to me that's like the NBA All-Star game. You got a bunch of guys that think really highly of themselves. And I think the strength of a team is recognizing talent in people that don't necessarily get six-figure salaries out of college. And they are really good at something, and they share your vision around what you're building. And then you got to figure out how to put a whole bunch of those guys together.
And so let's go back, that good segue back into Traeger. So Trilantic came up with the deal, asked you if you were interested. You're looking at the company. What was it that you saw in the company that said, yeah, I want to do this?
So a lot of it was based on my experience at Skullcandy. I had decided there were some things I loved about Skullcandy in terms of industry profile. There were some things I didn't love. You know, a youth-driven sort of trend brand is not necessarily easy to maintain day in, day out. And so I was looking for something similar in terms of old, sort of tired, non-innovating industry, but something that was built more around product disruption. And so I also recognize that creating magic is hard. And I didn't know that I knew how to create magic a second time. You know, I thought a lot about it. What really captured that lightning in the bottle at Skullcandy? And although I remember the period that it happened, I preferred to buy magic and build on it to scale something that existed. And so what I found in Traeger was magic. It was a small business that anyone who knew it loved it.
It was a small business. It was doing well. It also was a business that benefited from very strong patent protection. Mm-hmm. When Trilantic came in, or I guess when the first group, and am I pronouncing it right there?
Barish.
Barish?
Yep.
It's probably a family name. That's an awful name for an investment.
Barish. Yep.
Right, because you want to be bullish, you don't want to be bearish.
But
okay,
right.
Barish. It was just coming off a patent. And the lack of competition is a wonderful thing when you own the business. But as far as fine-tuning the systems and the procedures, folks can get sloppy because they don't need to really scrutinize everything. Was there some of that at Traeger?
Traeger, yes. Traeger was many decades old when we bought it. And I would sort of characterize Joe Traeger as a product innovator, a disruptor, a big vision guy, but he wasn't a sales and marketing guy. And that's why this amazing product was on its second, third generation in the Pacific Northwest, but you get down to Texas where people talk about barbecue and no one had ever heard of it. And so the guy that owned the business between Joe and us, a guy named Keith Barish, had a big vision, but he was a sales guy. And so he didn't focus on building brand. He didn't invest deeply in product innovation. And so when you have a patent, you can relax a little bit and know that, you know, you have a moat around your business. When the patent wears off, in the world of consumer products, it's about who innovates the fastest, who knows their consumer the best, who builds the highest quality product. And we had a team in place that, frankly, wasn't configured to do any of those things.
So that's a big hurdle,
Huge.
Not only were those pieces missing, but you had a culture that had evolved around a different world that no longer existed. How did you go about changing that?
Well, I tried to change it for a period of time. I tried to define vision and direction and cultural values. And I got sort of 12 months into that process. And I had this cynical realization, which is people actually don't change that much. And so the best way to change the culture and the energy and sort of the lenses through which a team sees the world is actually to make a lot of changes to the team.
And that's unfortunately often the case in the world of private equity. Making changes are hard. How'd you go about deciding, you know, which folks are going to stay, which folks are going to leave, and then bring in the new team? Take us inside that.
Yeah.
I imagine that was the better part of a year,
yeah.
that whole process. What
yep.
was that like?
So it was a hard process. As someone who'd spent more time in startups than in more mature businesses, I didn't have this experience of sort of turning around a team and pulling a team apart and putting it back together. And that was hard for me to do. When you build a team from ground zero, you know where your weaknesses are because you built them. And when you inherit something that's 30 years old, you got to figure it out. So I spent a lot of time understanding the quality of the people. Are they good or not? Are they willing to be part of a new culture with a new vision or not? And I will say that of the 140 or so people that were in the business 3 years ago, maybe 25 of them are with us today. And so ultimately,
changing culture is hard.
Changing culture is really hard. And that is actually ultimately the reason why I shut down a 30-year-old headquarter office. It's I needed to preserve what was sacred in the product and the solution, but I needed to build the team differently around it. And so I relocated it here to Utah.
That's a huge change. How long did it take into the process? How long were you there until you realized you needed to make a change at that level?
So I was 6 months with the business when I realized that Trilantic and I saw the world differently than our majority partner. Keith Barish, who did a nice job with the business, didn't understand that it was heading the wrong direction and wasn't willing to rip this thing apart and put it back together. And so I think decision point number one was, if we're going to fix this thing, if we're going to create something that lasts forever, we got to own it. And so we went from owning 48% to owning 100%. That was sort of decision point number one. The next was getting aligned with Trilantic around how aggressive we were going to be in this business. And I sort of came to them and said, we got to do the following 50 things. And they said, why don't you choose 5 things on that list? And we negotiated and we compromised. And the team rebuilding process, it was very carefully sequenced, but it took about 18 months to do.
And that's hard because during that 18-month period, there's uncertainty with the team that's staying.
The culture was hard during that period. I mean, we had some very painful incidences where, I felt uncomfortable. At one point, I felt unsafe, and it took time to make that change. And honestly, I probably wouldn't have done it had I known I would have had to have gone through that. But I look back and say, it's the best time of my career now. I'm glad. Ignorance is bliss. I'm glad I didn't know getting into it. It was better.
Yeah, no, it's hard. Talk to us about, with the benefit of hindsight, was doing that over 18 months in your situation? I mean, a lot of your Harvard professors would tell you, if you're going to do something like that, make the changes over a shorter period of time and go from a period of uncertainty for your team to a period of certainty as quickly as you can.
So I was in the camp of bolder and faster, and Trilantic was a bit of the governor behind slowing this thing down a little bit. And so what I didn't want to do was break a 30-year-old brand that had, you know, even with an average to poor management team, had survived that long. And so I had to step back and say, how do I sequence this in such a way that I don't break it, but I'm doing bold things with ERP systems and digital platforms and new marketing teams and new CFO and, I mean, new everything. And so the reality is that we actually, if you step back and think about what we did, it was pretty aggressive and was pretty fast, but we made investments that I believe take this business a long way out in the future.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Jeremy Andrus. He's the past CEO of Skull Candy, and he's currently the CEO of Traeger Pellet Grills. Yeah, life is complicated, right? You wanted to go bold. You had a financial partner that had just written a big check to buy out Bearish from the firm. They're looking at a lot of dollars. In hindsight, with the benefit of seeing how well it's worked for you, they, of course, would have said go quicker. But oftentimes this is how life is. You've got to balance things and you've got to figure out how to make it work, even though it's not 100% the way you wanted to do it. That's just a reality of being a CEO for a firm that you personally don't own 100% of. So take us forward. Where is the company today because of those changes?
So the company is doing really, really well right now. You know, we're growing top and bottom line nicely. We have a really, really good team. It's lean. It works well together. Our brand is on fire right now.
I mean, pardon the pun.
Yeah, exactly. We have a
smoking.
It is smoking hot. Thank you. We have a net promoter score in the low 80s, which is higher than any brand I have ever heard of. And you know, I will say that my first 18 months at Traeger were the hardest of my career. But what I had was a great financial partner. And the benefit of sort of pattern recognition, if this had been my first time through, I would have been dead. And so we're now in this place where there's inertia behind, there's positive inertia behind the business, and it is growing. It is growing in an industry that's not growing, and it is taking share very rapidly.
Well, you know, it's funny how life works. Probably a month ago, one of my buddies up in Park City told me about this great new grill that he got. And it was shortly after that, Ross Chambliss here at the studio told me we'd be talking. And it was just crazy because, you know, here I was talking to a friend at Starbucks, and he was so excited about this new grill. I mean, when I get a new grill, I don't talk to my buddies about it, right? I buy normally a Weber. I'll seriously look at the Traeger unit next time.
Only if you care about how your food tastes.
Other than that, buy whatever you want, right?
Right.
But I just thought it was funny that he was so passionate about this. And I think he said he bought it at one of the big boxes, maybe Home Depot up there.
Could
in
be
Park
Home
City.
Depot or Costco, yep.
Are you guys, so is that something new when you took over? Were you already in the big box retailers, or was that part of the new and improved strategy?
New and improved. So Home Depot is an account that we tested about 180 doors last year, about 450 this year. We'll grow to 800 doors next year. And so we are strengthening the brand, and we're adding to the distribution footprint.
So the big boxes, as a consumer, I enjoy occasionally, particularly Costco, because they pay their employees well. I think it's a good place to work, so I feel better about shopping there and being part of that ecosystem. So as a consumer, places like Costco are just amazing what you can get. The flip side of that, I'm fairly frugal, as regular listeners of the show know. And so Costco appeals to me. The flip side of that, though, is they're just brutal on the buying side and the term side. How did that change your business?
And so I can confirm that is the case. I love being a member at Costco, and I love what Costco does for our business. And I would sort of preface that with saying that we are building this brand in environments where you can have an assisted sale. Because when you walk in to buy a grill, you know what a gas grill is. You know what a charcoal grill is. Some people know what a smoker is. Nobody knows what a wood pellet grill is. And so we love to sell into specialty retail environments like Ace Hardware, local barbecue specialty. Costco, actually, for a big box, also gives us the ability to stand at a point of sale and to pitch thousands of people around the country every day. And so I have a real respect for the power of the Costco model, but it's really one element of our broader strategy, which is we need to create awareness to the broader consumer set as to what a Traeger is.
And so in your past experience, one of the ways that you built awareness cost effectively and did it really, really well is celebrity endorsements. Is there a celebrity endorsement? Is there a smoker grill celebrity out there? Probably is, but unfortunately it doesn't have the reach that some of the celebrities that Skull Candy had. How do you go about making Traeger more of a household name?
So we're doing a number of things. There is an influencer model, and we've actually brought some people on our team. There are three segments that we focus on, consumer segment. There's sort of this this backyard pitmaster guy, like me, wannabe pitmaster. There is this outdoorsman, someone who shops at Cabela's or Shields. They hunt, they harvest their game, they cook it on their Traeger. And then there's this more sort of culinary enthusiast. My wife, mid-30s, you know, she doesn't get excited about a dead elk. She gets excited about some nice recipe that she can cook for her family.
And that, I'm guessing, is the large, the biggest segment, the third that you mentioned.
The third is the biggest, but the most passionate and the easiest to speak to are the first two. And so, give you an example. We brought on a woman onto the Traeger influencer team. Her name is Danielle, Diva Q. She has a barbecue show that's in 137 countries around the world. If you are in barbecue, you know who Diva Q is. We're bringing people on board on the other two segments as well. And that's one piece of the strategy is to create circles of influence, whether they're local, regional, or national. That's one piece of it. I'll tell you another one that's been really interesting for us and a place where I had no experience is direct response TV. You know, again, you think about how do we scale awareness? And when I first looked at that channel, I said, oh, sham, wow. You know, there are no great brands that sell direct on TV.
It's big money, though. People that know how to do that are minting money.
You know what? I'm actually surprised by how well it's working. We're selling a $750 spot on Remnant Media at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it is just cranking. And what it does for us is that we sell and we pay for the media, but what it really does is it takes the 99% of people who don't convert and it drives them back into retail. And so, you know, we're still not a big brand, and we still think about how can we be incredibly resourceful around how we tell brand and category stories and really broaden the funnel of awareness.
Now, it seems to me, as somebody that knows very little about your space, that Facebook and YouTube, you know, anybody looking for on YouTube for a grilling recipe, they would be a natural. I imagine you are using those channels. And am I right? Are those effective?
Absolutely. Yeah, YouTube is fantastic. In fact, a lot of the content, there are tens of thousands of user-generated videos on YouTube that we just step back and say, I can't believe the number of our consumers creating and uploading videos. And it's their hobby, it's their passion. And so what we try to do is facilitate and create community. But it's been interesting for me to watch, you know, in the Traeger community, there's so much love and passion that it's almost self-organizing.
That's nice. You know, it's interesting how quickly the world is changing. My teenage daughters really don't watch television anymore. They watch they have 5-minute chunks that they like to use, and they're either on Snapchat. And for the grown-ups in the audience that haven't tried Snapchat, it is wonderful. You really should give it a try. And it's grown up past its roots. There's people out there chuckling, but it's grown past that initial roots. It's a very powerful tool. It's a great way to keep up with your teenagers. But they want to do things in chunks of time as opposed to sitting down and watching television. I'm curious. I don't have the opportunity to ask this question to many people, and I'm just curious of it as an individual. When I go on YouTube, they have these like 3-second commercials, and then you can click skip or you can keep watching it. My understanding is the business model there is the brand doesn't pay for that commercial as soon as right after it plays, I hit skip.
Yep.
Have you guys done that, and how does that model work?
Yes, we are doing that. So first of all, the best thing that we can do is be a brand. And brands don't just build hard goods, they create great content. content is what creates connection with a consumer. And so for us, part of the content is recipe content. You know, we've created 3,000 recipes over the last couple of years. We create lifestyle content. How do you use it? Who uses it? And so on YouTube, for example, the goal is to create content that gets someone past that five-second period. Now, you don't pay for it if they skip it, but we would prefer to say, if we can create great content and get them 10, 15, 20 seconds in, we will gladly pay to acquire that customer.
You know, when I go on YouTube, I'm there on a mission. I Googled something, I'm looking for an answer, and it's on YouTube, and I'd rather just skim something very quickly, get the answer, and move on. But I've got to go to YouTube for the answer. Then I get this commercial. Shockingly, half the time, it's like, ugh. And I know I'm doing it, but it's like, all right, they hooked me. I'm curious, and
I keep
watching
it.
Yeah.
You got to hook them fast. And we think about that. How do we ensure that we are getting in front of the right consumer and we're saying the right things in a split second to get them to watch? Our experience has been, and this has been interesting for me in Costco, for example, more than 95% of the people that walk in and buy a Traeger grill at Costco were not coming in to buy a grill that day. In fact, they had no intention of buying a grill that year. And so what we've learned is that if we can get in front of a consumer and say the right things, we have a solution that's so incredibly appealing and disruptive that we can sell to them. And so we think a lot about, you know, in Costco, it's not the 5 second, it's I got 2 minutes and 15 seconds to deliver a very, very compelling script that tells someone why they are not in the market for a grill that compels them to spend $1,000 that day.
If you're just joining us today, our guest is Jeremy Andrus. He's the past CEO of Skull Candy. He's currently the CEO of Traeger Pellet Grills. You know, it's funny you say that, because when I go to Costco, half the things I take home, I was not planning on taking home. They are better than anybody at doing it. Which brings up an interesting point. If 95% of the people that are going home with a $600, $700, $800 wood pellet grill did not go to Costco thinking they were going to do that. What about returns? How do you handle returns?
So fortunately, what we've learned is that people don't return Traegers very often. The hardest part is to get them to take it home. We do something that we call the chicken challenge, which is we send them home with a grill and a little bit of chicken rub, Traeger chicken rub, and say go to the website, find the chicken challenge recipe. And if it's not the best chicken you've ever eaten in your life, bring the grill back. People do that. They do that challenge. And people don't really bring them back. Now, Costco has a fairly liberal return policy.
2 years. I mean, it's crazy how liberal it is.
It's actually closer to life. I mean, we get some well-enjoyed product back. And so we actually have a facility in Spanish Fork that we bring all that product back. And what we've tried to do with it actually is give grills to fire stations because they appreciate it, they love it, and we want to get use of them somewhere. So we refurbish it and we give it to fire stations.
That's
typically.
Nice. Well, that's one way to handle returns. It also tells me you don't get many returns. That would get very expensive very quickly.
It would. I mean, the hardest part about a return is not just the cost of goods that you're getting back. When it's a 150-pound grill, you've got this reverse logistics cost to get it back into the warehouse. And so, you know, fortunately, if we get someone to take it home, they love it.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad to hear that. And it speaks to the quality of the grill. We were talking earlier about kind of the shakeup at the headquarters. There was also a shakeup, if my notes are correct, in the manufacturing of the grills. They used to be made here in the United States. They're now made in Asia, is that correct?
That's correct.
Talk to us about that decision. How hard was it to make the decision? What was it like trying to set up manufacturing in China? Obviously, through Skull Candy, you had a lot of experience in that area. Probably different factories make these earbuds than make 150-pound grills.
You bet. Guessing. Well, so interestingly, that decision was made under Keith Barish. Joe Traeger built everything in Oregon. And Keith Barish, his vision was the right one, which is, If we don't manufacture overseas, we can't get our price point down to a mass market product. So when we took over, I had a lot of experience sourcing product in China, mostly southern China, with very sophisticated manufacturers. What I found when I toured the Traeger factories for the first time was quite surprising. I mean, they were out in the sticks. They were 5, 6, 7 hours northwest of Shanghai in very much still agrarian communities.
Well, these, sort of, things probably outdoors.
Yeah, I mean, these are first-generation farmers that have sort of created these factories. They're steel welders. And I was shocked when I saw our contract manufacturers for the first time. I knew that we had a lot of work to do. Keith Barish actually had never went to China. And I'm a much more hands-on operator. And so I've been to China 50 times over the last 10 years. And so it was important to me to really understand our China operation. Turns out we had issues. We had IP issues there. We had embezzlement issues there. We had some good and some bad in our manufacturing, but mostly bad. And we had to figure out which of these partners are willing to invest in this operation. And some of them we stayed with, and we added some more sophisticated partners in southern China.
You know, normally when people say we had some good and some bad, they say mostly good.
It was mostly bad.
So that's a really difficult thing, and getting the Chinese manufacturing correct is really hard. Yeah. It takes a lot of time there. It sounds like you went there initially. Did you lead that exploration for, I assume you had to change manufacturers, and did you lead that, or was there somebody on your team that could do that for you?
So I was very involved in that process, but when there are 100 moving pieces in the business, you really need highly focused, highly specialized people. So I have a chief supply chain officer. He and I worked together at Skull Candy for a number of years. I knew that he knew China. And actually, he's in China this week. And he still goes to China 6 or 7 times a year. Very involved. And we have an office of 30 people over there. But I am a big believer that as an owner of a business, as a CEO, as sort of an executive team, if you are not in your factories in China, they don't take you seriously in terms of quality specs and cost negotiations and just the quality of your sub-suppliers. And so I'm a believer that this guy's there all the time, even with the team over there. And I still get over there as often as I can. And China's still, I think people that haven't manufactured there think there's, a command P for production. And the reality is that China is still very much the wild, wild west. And you have to manage it very closely. Your partners, they think about IP and ethics slightly differently. And you got to be very involved. Otherwise, you end up with quality issues and you end up with cost issues.
Well, let's talk about the IP issue, because I know that's another big one when you go overseas. What kind of issues were you having, and how does a company protect their IP?
So we learned 6 months into my tenure at Traeger that one of our factories had patented all of our products, all of our designs in China. And, the potential repercussion of that is that at any point in time,
the biggest consumer market in the world, or maybe India is the biggest, but
it's a massive consumer market. My fear, though, was that it tied us to this manufacturer, and if we ever got sideways with them, they would simply go to the export commission and say they're producing elsewhere. We own the patents. You got to shut them down. And so that was a very scary standoff for us, where we potentially, could have disrupted all of the production. And I really believe that in a contract manufacturing model, as much as you stay involved and you manage and you drive, the best way to keep your partners honest is to have redundant supply. And so, I actually got on an airplane, went to China. It was a very delicate issue because in China, you don't want to offend. You need to save face, but for something like that, we needed to make sure that we won that battle and we got that IP signed back over to us.
And were you able to do that at the negotiating table, or did you have to take legal action?
We did not have to take legal action. His partners actually turned out to be a great partner. I understand why they did it. I took their answer at face value, but the reality is that When they knew that I was coming over there, they took it very seriously. And so there was a lot of back-channel discussion that happened. And we actually got it fixed within weeks before I landed in China. And when I landed and I met with this partner, I effectively ignored the issue. It had been fixed.
That's awesome. And, you know, unfortunately, that's what it takes, right? And China is literally on the other side of the world. So it comes with its pros and its cons. One of the cons of manufacturing in China is it takes away jobs from the U.S. That's a hot issue in this election cycle. As we record this, the election is about 6 weeks away. Can you see a day down the road where Traeger would be back to manufacturing here in the U.S.? Or is it like Apple Computers, Steve Jobs famously has told political leaders, those jobs are gone and they're never coming back?
You know, it's a good question. I think the reality is that, first of all, it's all about the cost of labor. And then you've got this balance between labor cost and automation. So Chinese wages have been rising for 10 years, like at a very consistent double-digit clip. And so one of the things that we're seeing in our factories is more automation. If you'd asked me 5 years ago, I would say, this is a steel welding operation. It is by hand. And we're actually seeing more automation. I can see a day where lower cost manufacturing leaves China. Does it come back to the U.S.? Probably not. I just it's hard for me to envision that the economics work for that. And so, you know, there are some higher tech, but they also tend to be more automated operations that will end up back in the U.S.
And how about the design? Is that all done here in the U.S.?
Yes. Yeah. Anything that's consumer facing, we do. Industrial design, graphic design, you know, even the functional design of the electronics that we build, all of the innovation happens here, and we take the know-how over there and we teach them to do it.
So this is the first time I'm asking the CEO this question, but I think it's going to become more and more relevant going forward. The whole fields of machine learning and artificial intelligence, I think we're on the cusp of really powerful leveraging technology coming to our everyday lives in a good way. I initially, as I asked this question, I'm thinking there's probably not a lot of application today, but I don't know. Are you guys utilizing any machine learning or AI in your business?
So we're working on it. I believe there's room for that in every business. Any business that has a customer needs to understand that customer. They need to know how to speak to them, what to offer them, and they need to know how to do it quickly. And so, you know, we think about that. We think about what are the technologies that we can bring into our business. We have a database of, you know, upwards of a million consumers, and they all look different. How do we know what to offer them? What product? What price point? And so, I would say that we're early in really understanding how to utilize that. But it is absolutely something that I think about.
You know, I had a customer experience the other day where. They said, you can text us if you have a question. It was on my phone. It was easier to do that. You know, click here and it opens up your messaging app. And I texted them and I got a very thoughtful reply. And it went on. Thought, well, that was a great experience. Went on to what I had to do. I read a couple weeks later that was a bot. It was not a human that had given me that thoughtful reply.
You know, it's amazing. Part of it happens on the consumer side and we're working on that. The other piece happens within the business operation. And so, you know, I was taking a group of Boy Scouts through our office not long ago, and I stood in one place, and I pointed to all of the different functions around the business and the fact that, you know, we're going to move 250 million pounds of stuff this year, steel and wood, in the country to 5,000 points of distribution. The inner workings of a business is complicated. And so, for example— my gross margin's down. If my gross margin's down, I don't just need to know that it's down. That's data point number one. I need machine learning to help me identify and draw correlations across the complicated business as to why it's down. And so I really believe that that is the future. On the customer side, it's, you know, how do I know each one quickly and individually? On the business operation side, it's, of 100 variables or 1,000 variables in my business, how do I find them, find correlations, and then make decisions from them quickly?
I'm curious. When the Boy Scouts came through, what was your favorite question from them?
You know, they couldn't fathom how we moved that much product to that many different points of distribution and got it right.
I'm having trouble fathoming it. 250 million pounds, that's a lot of product.
It's a lot. And by the way, it's expensive to move stuff, especially when you're moving a $19 bag of pellets that weighs 20 pounds. And so I think the Boy Scouts, none of whom have been to China, they were just fascinated by how it all started there and ended up over here.
So you've got a group of future Girl Scouts at home, and I understand recently added two future Boy Scouts to the team as well. We've only got a couple minutes left. Let me transition to kind of how do you balance it all? How do you be a great dad and a great CEO?
Boy, that is the million-dollar question, and I would say that I'm getting better at it, and part of the reason I'm getting better at it is that I love spending time with my family so much. And so, you know, in the Skullcandy days, I didn't ever figure it out. You know, for 8 years, I went from single to married to three little girls. And I worked every single day, and I traveled hundreds of thousands of miles a year, and I didn't ever find balance. And part of that's that there was this level of need to succeed. And I got done, and I said, that's not the right way to live life. First of all, I was tired. I needed to figure out how to sort of not recharge every 8 years, but recharge every day and every week. And so I would say part of it's around the team I've built and how I've structured my team. I had 14 direct reports at Skullcandy. I have three at Traeger. I have three of the best people. And I've built an organization that way that allows me to focus on vision, culture, and people. The second is that you sort of realize how to be more effective during the day. Everybody has 100 things to do. And so you don't win by doing 90 of those things. You win by picking the five things that move the needle in your business and doing them well. And so I probably don't move as fast, but I'm a lot smarter about what I do.
That's an awesome note for us to end on. Jeremy, thank you for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest this morning has been Jeremy Andrews. He is the CEO of Traeger Pellet Grills. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you, Ross. You can hear our entire interview with Jeremy on our website, kcpw.org. You can tweet me, nicely please, at SavvyWells or at KCPW Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.